Proverbs 16. Let's go there, shall we? Eater. 16:1-3. Let's go here. Somebody read that. 16:1-3, the trifecta.
The plans of the heart belong to man, but the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. All the ways of man are pure in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the spirit. Commit your work to the Lord, and your plans will be established.
All right, so this is a great, just a good practical life verse for what in the world is God going to do with you, and how do you know what's the will of God, right? My experience in this and everything I've learned is, and I'm a simpleton, as you guys have probably figured out, but the idea with this idea of committing your works to the Lord and your plans will be established, God's going to weigh your heart. Put your plans before Him. Take your life map and say, God, this is what I feel like you're leading me to go do. These are the dreams and the aspirations that you put on my heart. After looking at my gifts and my background and my experience and the things I get passionate about, this is where I feel like you're leading me. And then as a good sailor, you put your sail up in the wind and you let God blow it wherever He wants to. And you say, Lord, you direct my path. Okay, you weigh the motives of my heart. I think there needs to be a fundamental belief in all of us that God desires to use us in great ways, that He has given us the history that we have and the skill set that we have to do great things, and that He wants to use us to affect His kingdom. And we don't always know how, right? When I was in seminary, I never ever saw, off the front wasn't even, I would have laughed at you. I didn't know anything about bikes. I didn't know anything about kids. I didn't know anything about poverty. I didn't know anything about Fresno, right? No idea that was coming, but God did. And I think He knows me a little bit better than I know me, right? So when that opportunity came and it was laid kind of before me in a pretty, it felt for me, clear way. All right, so God, I've been doing this for now 10, 11 years being a pastor, and I still get to do a piece of this, obviously, that I love, but this is what you're steering me to. So, okay, right? So what you never want to do is, and I think we've said it here before, is lean on a shovel praying for a hole, right? You put everything out there. God tends not to steer parked cars, right? So you head in a direction and you let God direct the path. And if those things change and you hit a fork in the road, then, man, you assume that, all right, God, that's where you want me to go, okay, and move forward. I don't know if you guys wrestle with this, but I've seen it in, I don't know, my generation is a lot of us were going through college life, and that season it was, man, everyone got real hung up on the will of God. Like, what does He want me to do? And we viewed the will of God as this extremely narrow tightrope that we had to walk. And I just don't see God's will like that. I think it's wide and there's tons of things that fit within it. And I think if we're obedient and walking with Him and obeying the things that we know to be true in Scripture, which is, man, stay usable, okay? Keep filling yourself with the Word. Repent as necessary, and continue to obey Him as best you can. The will of God for us can be really, really wide. And it doesn't have to be something that we get freaked out about, right? Of, gosh, do you want me to turn left or turn right here? I don't know. Well, maybe it's either, and it doesn't matter, right? So love God and pursue those things. So as you guys think through your life plans, pursue them. Pursue them with an open hand and be sensitive and listening, and make sure that God's the one that's directing paths and you're not kicking down doors. But at the ultimate end of the day, God's going to weigh your motives and God's going to direct and steer you in whatever areas that you desire to go into. And He knows you better than you know you, and He desires to use you, each of you, in great ways, okay? And you have certain gifts and talents and skills that are going to be put to use for Him in great ways, all right? So I remember reading this verse sitting in the KT guest house in Bangkok, Thailand in 1997 in the midst of, like, Lord, I have no, it was just one of those seasons where I'm not sure what you want to do with me, God. I was on a mission trip, and this just has always been one of those things where, well, Lord, here's what I know, right? I need to be obedient. These are the dreams and aspirations that I have. From there, it's kind of up to you. So I'm going to keep running, and hopefully that door is soft when I hit it, if that's not where you want me to go. And if not, steer me another direction. So, all right. Thoughts on God's will, or just aspirations in life, or what to do with those, or any of you wrestling with those seasons right now of forks in the road, or where do I go? Right.
Do, just like you said, like trying on different things, and then eventually, like, you'll find your passion?
Yeah, that's how I had to find it, I think, and it took me a long time. I think, honestly, it took me 30 years to figure out who I was. Like, how am I wired? What do I like? What do I don't like? What do I get excited about? You know, trying to figure out how to not imitate somebody else because I liked them or respected them, and, I'm actually not gifted that way. So I think that's a lot of it, and I'm a big believer in you are where you are for a reason. God put you there. So you have a unique spot in life. You can do ministry from that vantage point like nobody else can, with your job and your oversight of, you know, people that work for you. God's called you there, right? So my thought is, well, until God calls me to leave this place, then this is where I'm supposed to be. Now, if God's opening up other doors and those seem exciting and fun and fit me, I'm gonna go pursue them. And if God says no, great, then here I am. And if God says yes, then here we go. So now, if you're like, man, I hate this, it's a burden to me, I don't like it, it's not my gifting, I'm failing, those are good conversations to consider as well. But I think God puts us where he puts us for a reason. It's not an accident. And say, Lord, this is where you have me. I'm going to pursue this to the full until you uproot me and give me the peace in my soul to move on to somewhere else to where I go, yeah, I feel released from this place. And until I feel released, I'm not going to move. So does that make sense? And that can be difficult. I've got a buddy who's an engineer here in town. He's on our board at Off the Front, and he has had just a beating of a last 6 years with his job, right? Great engineer. His company has just been like this, and they've been laying off people and firing people, and they don't replace people. So it's like, okay, you need to do his job and her job and your old job. You know, and that's kind of been the end. And we're not going to give you a raise, and it's, you know, we're not going to say thank you. It's just expected. And he's had opportunities to move on to other places for, you know, career advancement. And he just feels like, you know what, this is where God has me. And every time I try to pursue another avenue that would seem to be a good career move, God shuts it down. And it doesn't make sense to me, but okay. So he's just been steadfast and trotted through it, and God is slowly changing some circumstances to where it may work out in his favor, but he's just been faithful. And now within the company, he's viewed as a very key component of the success of that local branch, because he's stayed and everyone else has kind of abandoned ship, and he's just kind of stayed and bailed water, right, and done his job and been faithful. And so, yeah, it's hard to figure that out at times. I know it's a long answer to a short question, but I'm a big fan of stay where you're at till God's released you. But I think especially in this season of life for you guys, those are the questions that we're asking. Okay, I'm, you know, either in college or I'm through those college years, and like the permanency of a job and life and kids and marriage is like on the horizon. Like, what in the world am I supposed to do, right? Like, I had trouble choosing a major, much less a career path, right? Like, I don't know, you know. It took me 2 years to figure out what I wanted to major in college. You know, how am I supposed to know at 23 who I'm supposed to marry? Like, that person's gonna be around for a long time, I think. So, I don't know. So, anyway. How do others of you guys handle such moments in life? Any insider wisdom? I have lots of bad ideas, and I don't know they're bad until about 48 hours later, right? And I'm glad that often I don't act on those, because they were great ideas 48 hours previous to that. And I'm like, oh, that was stupid. You know, so I'm like, good, right? So, yeah. Like Mark Twain, count 10, or Huck Finn. Who is it? Not Mark Twain. Tom Sawyer, count 10. So, one of those books I was supposed to read in middle school and didn't. So, there you go.
He was in the Cliff Notes, thank God.
All right. Thank you, Jesus, for Cliff Notes. All right, let's go to Judges. There's our boy Gideon. So that's
when you close your eyes and dream about Gideon at night. There he is right there. He is the egg. So think of him. Yeah, big fan. All right, so bye-bye. Like you said, he's pretty. All right, so back to Judges. We are in chapter, what, six?
Jeez. Ish. Fabulous. All right.
So let's kind of just review quickly. It's life of Gideon, and I think there's a great message in here. We talked about the great message maybe with Ehud and you know, this potentially handicapped guy, and you know, how a less than obvious guy could have been used for great ways, and just the encouragement that brings to us who are less than perfect. How about Gideon? Why is it significant that God would say to him, "Hey, you're about to judge Israel. Okay, you're about to lead for a season. You're about to be the guy. But before you go do anything, go tear down your daddy's altar in your backyard." Why is that so significant? And what if you guys were leading a group of junior high school kids, which many of you guys are, and you have influence in their lives, what's the message in that for them?
Appearance, kind of like your household.
Yeah.
So what, he's going to judge, people are going to look up to him, and so what does his household look like? What are they going to look like?
Yeah, it's good, right? What do his own parents say about him? You're going to see it's interesting. His dad's about to save his bacon in a pretty significant way. He about gets killed for doing what he's going to do. So, okay, what else?
Before you, like, want to go reach the community or serve at large, you need to, like,
Yeah.
And so, and that's going to be the hardest witness that if you start there first.
Yep.
The people that are acquaintances and stuff.
Yeah. I think that's right on, right? Where has God put you? Who else has influence in that home? Who knows you better than your parents, right? Your faults, your weaknesses, your temper, your whatever it is, right? And for you to be able to witness to them is significant, right? And I think on another scale, no one else has that relationship in the home that you have, right? No one else can be so-and-so's son or daughter or brother of whatever. No one else has that, right? Those are relationships that are unique to you. God can raise anybody he wants to lead Israel, right? That is not unique to Gideon's gifting. And we've seen that already. We've already had four judges, and there's going to be several after him that are qualified in different ways. But he's the only guy that is the son of, what's his face? I can't remember now, right? It's good to remember that. Sometimes we get those skewed, right? There is only one husband to Michelle Sladen, and I am the only dad of the three kids that I have in my home. Nobody else can have that role but me. Now, God can use anyone to run off the front. He could get a new residency teacher in here tomorrow. That's not unique to me, right? So my focuses need to be in alignment with that, right? That those things need to come first in terms of my life and where I'm investing my time and my energy. And it's not that these things don't matter, but they just matter less, right? And if I'm failing at home, then why do you guys care what I say up here, right? You shouldn't. So just good to keep in mind, okay? Especially for folks that are super zealous about, I'm going to go save the world. And but, like, you can't take out the trash and your parents hate you because you can't clean your room and you're disobedient and disrespectful to them, right? How about get it done at home first? So I appreciate that, that's well said. Okay. So for you guys that are thinking through that, that's great. And I think for in ministries where you're influencing kids, young adults that are growing into maturity, it's a good reminder to them that, man, where has God put you? Bloom there first and then go save the world and go save the world too. Okay. But make sure you get it done at home. All right. So that's the command. Verse 24, chapter 6. Okay. He builds this altar after God does some amazing things and consumes the offering that he had. Okay, in 25 and following, we're going to look at this altar now that God calls him to burn down or to take down, I guess. So before we do that, somebody pray for us, and then we will dive into the rest of Gideon's story and finish that up this morning. So,
dear Lord, I just want to thank you for today, and just for being Friday, God, and I just ask that as we read that you just show us something that we can just go on all day, Lord.
Amen. All right. So, 25. Let's pick up there and let's watch how Gideon goes about this command from God, okay, to take care of it at home. So I'm going to pick up there.
That night the Lord said to him, "Take your father's bull and the second bull, 7 years old, and pull down the altar of Baal. that your father has and cut down the Asherah that is beside it.
All right, so where is this altar? It belongs to his father. It's probably in his backyard, right? So this is right next to the, you know, the swing set. Okay, so this is in their backyard. Go tear it down. And what else?
And build an altar to the Lord your God on the top of the stronghold here.
So this is probably, as most altars were, on some type of hilltop. It would have been the higher place. So they would build them on the highest point that they could find, and that's where they would go worship. Okay, so you're going to now tear that down, and you're going to go build another one in its place. And notice how many altars there are. You got Baal and Asherah. So the two primary pagan gods that they're worshiping right now are these two. Okay? So keep going.
Then take the second bowl and offer it as a burnt offering with the wood of the Asherah that you shall cut down.
All right. So that's the command, right? So go do this. Okay? Take care of it. Now, how do you think Gideon feels about that? How would you guess? Scared, right? And I think that's a fair feeling, right? And God's going to honor that. So I appreciate that. He's honest about his, like, man, I'm freaking out about this, right? I don't want to go do this, so I'm not even going to go do it during the day. 27, he's so scared, he does it at night. Evan, read that.
So Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord had told him. But because he was too afraid of his family and the men of the town to do it by day, he did it by night.
Does he get it done? Yeah, does he do it in a way that he does it while everyone's asleep, really quietly, right? Slowly dismantling the altar, right? Right? Don't wake up dad. And I like that about him, right? He gets it done. He's scared. It's like, well, is God going to honor that? And sure enough, he does. Okay, so verse 28, keep reading.
When the men of the town rose early in the morning, behold, the altar of Baal was broken down, and the Asherah beside it was cut down. And the second bowl was offered on the altar that had been built.
Huh, odd. Okay, what else do you notice about 28? What do you see already in Gideon's life in terms of people rallying to him? Does he do this by himself?
He got
10 guys. What does that tell you about his personality? Are people attracted to that? Like, I'm going to do something crazy, right? Come with me. Okay, what do they need? They need someone to be crazy first, right? And say, hey, I'm willing. I'm going to go do this. Drew a line in the sand. Come with me. There were other people that wanted to, but no one had the courage to do it. And Gideon wasn't like, you know, Conan courage. He's just like, well, you know what? We're going to do it at night because I'm scared. But that's as much as I can muster right now. So, and they were down with that, right? So just interesting. He's going to draw more people around him as well. But you see underneath this scared kid pressing or in a wine press winnowing wheat, you see the potential in this guy. And God saw that as well. So he's got a personality that is attractive to other people that they want to go do that with him. All right? So they all wake up in the morning and realize, rut row 29.
And they said to one another, who has done this thing? And after they had searched and inquired, they said, Gideon, the son of Joash, has done this thing.
So he does this at night so that no one would know he did it. And it takes a verse for them to figure out, oh, it's Gideon. I'm like, oh, crap, now what do I do? Right? 30, then the men of the city said to Joash, this is his pops, bring out your son that he may die. Okay, so they're fairly angry, okay? For he has torn down the altar of Baal, and indeed he has cut down the Asherah, which is beside it. Now, given that these two altars are in Joash's backyard, who does Joash worship? Baal and Asherah, right? So that's what Gideon grew up watching, okay? So Joash is going to make a statement that's absolutely brilliant. So he's in hot water because he's like, well, I'm a fan of these gods because I've been worshiping and I probably erected that altar in my backyard so that everyone else could come and worship, but that's my kid and I prefer him not die, okay? So 31, read this. Right? If he's a God worth worshiping, he doesn't need us to stick up for him. Let him stick up for himself. He doesn't need, if he's getting bullied, then let him fight back. He's not worth worshiping if he can't defend himself, right? So, like, huh, that's okay. It's well said. And the men go, you know what? That actually makes sense. Therefore, on that day, verse 32, he named him Jerubbaal. This is now Gideon's name, which is bizarre, okay? So, that he gets named now after Baal. His name literally means let Baal contest for him. So that's the idea. So Gideon is called, let Baal defend for himself. Okay, so that's what they renamed this kid basically on the spot. Okay, so basically, Baal obviously does nothing. Asherah does nothing. They tear down this altar, and Baal can't contend for himself because he's a wooden figurine. Okay, G.I. Joe that does nothing, right? So because of this, now Gideon's got a rallying point. His dad saves his life, 33. Now they're going to get to battle.
All right, so real quick, here's where we're at, okay? Zumaga out. All right, so, are we on? All right, so Gideon's town is up, hee-haw, okay? So here is Jordan River. There's the Sea of Galilee up there. This is hometown right here. Okay, he's from Orpah in this area, okay, in, again, Manasseh. So he's about to go fight some battles down here in the next chapters, but this is where they're at right now. Okay, so he just tore down altars in his backyard.
Okay, and now they're going to get after it with the Midianites. 34, keep going.
But the Spirit of the Lord clothed Gideon, and he sounded the trumpet, and the Midianites were called up to follow him, and he sent messengers throughout all Manasseh, and they too were called up to follow him, and he sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, and they went up to meet them.
All right, so he realizes, man, I got 10 guys that came with me to tear down an altar. If I put the word out, maybe some other people come with me. Gideon said to God, verse 36, if you will deliver Israel through me as you have spoken, man, we're good, but he needs another sign. See, you see this fear that continues to lie underneath the surface with Gideon. It's not crippling fear. He still moves to action, but yet, even after a kind of a significant high point, he's still scared. So he sends out letters, and then he realizes, oh gosh, I just committed to fight. God, are you sure you're with me? So he says, I need another sign, God. Okay, and he's going to ask for two here. 37, here's the first one.
Behold, I am laying a fleece of wool on a threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece alone and it is dry on all the ground, then I shall know that you will save Israel by my hand as you have said.
Okay, so he's in the threshing floor, the wine press, or wherever he was. Okay, and he takes some skin of an animal and he says, if it's wet in the morning and everything around it's dry, then I'll know that you're with me. So why he chose that, I have no idea, but that's what he asked God for, okay? That's a really hard balance. I'm with you. Yeah, and one of the things that ticked Jesus off more than anything was they wanted signs, and he said, you're going to get nothing but the sign of Jonah, which was in 3 days, you know, Jonah got booted out of the whale's mouth, which is symbolic of you're going to see me raised from the dead. That's all the sign that you need. Somewhere underneath this, the heart of Gideon is, I guess in God's eyes, right, saying, listen, I need to move forward, but I need to know that you're on my team. And I think in a day when spirituality is pretty gray, if not black, in the book of Judges, he's saying, I want to follow you, but I need to know that you're in this before I move. That's the only, I don't know, that's how I see it in my head, that God honors this not once, but twice. And he's already honored the thing before with the altar and him going out at night. So for whatever reason, he allows him to do it. So No, I think in the same way that this wasn't sin for him to ask. I think he was scared and he was needing some reassurance that God was a part of the battle. I think the other signs that were asked for were Jesus had clearly demonstrated who he was before the people. And they were looking for more. They wanted more hocus pocus. And Jesus says, I've given you everything you need and yet you refuse to believe. I think there was a point where he said no more. It's hard to make sin contextual. That gets dangerous. There are issues where that is okay, though, right? Can I listen to the same music you listen to? Is it sin for me to listen to the same music? Well, it may be. It may cause in me things that are sin for me, where for you they don't. Well, if you're more mature and can handle that and it doesn't bring about sin in you, then it's not sin. So in some ways, there is some contextuality where if it's not black or white, I have to weigh in my own life. Is that healthy for me, right? Is that music or that movie or whatever is that, and it may be sin for one person and not for another, and that's hard. Yeah. Well, take the lying piece with Rahab. Did she lie? Absolutely. 100% she lied. Did God honor it? Yes. So is it lying okay?
I think too.
No.
When we're making a big decision, you're like, God, send me a sign. Like, this is a good decision for me to do. And I think that's what kind of Gideon's saying. Like, if this is what you want me to do, send me a sign saying that we can go fight and do that. So I know in my life, I pray hard about, like, serious decisions.
I'm with you. It's a big word. Yeah.
It might come in a small sign, but obviously, back in the day.
Yeah. And I think it's okay to ask for confirmation. I think if we hold God to the, I'm not going to move unless you, it's like, ooh, okay, hold on. Yeah, and I think the greater faith would have been, I don't need a sign. God, you came to me in a wine press and told me to go fight. I think God honors his lack of faith. His faith is small. Now, that doesn't mean that God's not going to deliver, but he realizes Gideon's not a guy that's going to be known for his awesome faith. He's just not there, right? And I think God realizes you're weak in that area, as I'm weak in that area. So you need reassurance, right? And there are areas where my faith is very, very small. And there's areas where it's, I think, stronger. But I think he honors that with him. So, yeah.
And if you ask for some kind of sign, that you got to be prepared for a no.
Yeah.
You got to be okay with it.
Yeah.
Not going to give you a sign.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm still going to move forward.
Yeah. But. Be careful not to take this too far, right, in terms of what that means for, well, then I can ask God for signs, and if he doesn't give me, I would agree. Yeah, it's descriptive, not prescriptive. So don't, God, you know, my car's flipped over upside down in the parking lot tomorrow morning, then I know that you want me to marry that girl. I know. Just, right, go ask her on a date. Don't be a stalker. See how, you know, right, and if it works out, it works out. And pray. And does she love Jesus? I don't, you know, so I've heard people get really, really weird with this stuff. And then it becomes a, God's now your vending machine. I pull, you deliver, I want that snack, you know, you, it's like, no. God is not on your timetable or your, you know, so be careful. But he honors this, not once, but twice. So I'm going to put this fleece out. I want it wet. I want all the ground dry. God says, great. Verse 38, and it was so. When he arose early the next morning, he squeezed the fleece, he drained the dew from the fleece, a bowl full of water. So does God honor his request? Does he do it? Exactly as Gideon asked. Yep, and then Gideon went, wait a second, maybe that was too easy, right? Maybe that was just like nature. Oh, I should ask for something else. God, one more time, do not let your anger, verse 39, burn against me that I may speak once more. Please let me test you once more with the fleece. Let it now be dry only on the fleece and let the dew be on the ground. So let's switch it. For whatever reason, that was more miracle than the other. So 40, what does God do? So Gideon's like, okay, that was the gentle shove that he needed to get out of the nest. So Gideon, go, I'm with you, okay? So good, better, best, a guy like David, I don't know, maybe he would have never asked for that because his faith is greater. Gideon's just not a guy with faith that is huge, but does God use him? He's patient, right? Aren't you glad he's that way with us when there's areas in our lives that are cracked and screwed up and he's like, I get it, you're flawed. You're not, this isn't your strong point. I'm going to work with you here. So thank God.
But does that also kind of point out like God's small miracles? Like, especially like things that we should be looking for in our life. Because like, could you walk outside one morning and not even notice that your front doormat's like,
why? Yeah, there's probably, and I think there's significant spiritual moments that we overlook and maybe not signs, but just God's directing past that I'm too busy and moving too fast to see. So, yeah, for sure. All right, so he gets his signs, okay?
Chapter 7 now, let's see him fight these battles with the enemy. So he's tried to rally some troops, he's put the word out, he's got his signs, and now we're going to get after it. So 7:1, pick up there.
And Jeroboam, that is Gideon, and all the people who were with him, rose early and encamped beside the spring of Herod. And the camp of Midian was north of them, by the hill of Moriah.
All right, so here we are, okay? They're about to divide their company into three, okay? So Gideon's going to bring his men over here. Midianites are up here, and they're going to fight this battle in the midst of the Jezreel Valley, okay? So just so you guys have a bit of a location, all right? Now, odd thing is verse 3, okay? They come in. How many people does Gideon rally initially, verse 3, the bigger number? 22,000 people. That's good. He had 10 guys help him build an altar, or tear down an altar, I guess, and build an altar. He puts the word out, right, sends an email, and 22,000 people show up. That's good news. Like, okay, we can fight now, right? Now, Midianites are a big deal, and they're scared, okay? So he says to them, hey, if you're scared, go back home, okay? And I think that was kind of like the Mel Gibson Braveheart speech. What he didn't expect, I think, was the end of verse 3. So 22,000 people remained, but 10,000 people returned, but 10,000 remained. So he actually has 32,000, my bad, 22,000 go home, so a third of them leave, and 10,000 stay. So two-thirds of his army was like, yep, scared, bye, they leave. So I think he was hoping for a little bit more like, you're all in, right? No, don't go, right? So not good. So I think he's automatically, you know, he doesn't have a lot of faith as it is, so where's God pushing on him? In that area, right? And God says, yeah, verse 4, that's still too many. 10,000 is way too many to beat the Midianites, which is, you know, humanly speaking, that's not good. You want more, not less, okay? So God says to Gideon, the people are still too many, verse 4, bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. And Gideon's like, no testing, right? This is fine, okay? I'm okay with 10,000. It's not too many, but that's not what God says, okay? Therefore, it shall be, whom I say, this one shall go with you, he shall go with you, but everyone else I'm going to send home, okay? And then verse 5, this is how they're going to do it. This is the test. Read that. All right, so how does a dog lap water? This is weird, but this is the test. You've seen they stick their face in the bowl, right? How do these other guys drink? Right, so what's the imagery? Why would that be more important? Why would God say, those are the guys I want to fight? Using their hands, but not just that. Think battle. They're aware. How so? That's the idea. They got one hand on their sword, right? And they got their head on a swivel. They're looking up as they're drinking water. You stick your face down in the water, you're done, right? So he says, those are the guys that I want, okay? Not good numbers, by the way, either, okay? 10,000, now we've just narrowed them down to 300, and God says, perfect, that's what we needed, okay? We needed 300 men that were ready to fight. That's all I need, okay? Now, how's Gideon feeling about right now? He had 32,000 men, right? And now he's got 1%. Of what he started with, right? So, all right, Gideon, let's work on your faith a little bit. Let's see how this is going to go. So here we go, verse 8, or 7, you tell everybody else to go home. Okay, verse 8, now we're going to take your 300 and you, and we're going to go fight. Pick up there.
So the people took provisions in their hands and their trumpets, and he sent all the rest of Israel, every man to his tent, but retained the 300 men. And the camp of Midian was below him in the valley. That same night, the Lord said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I have given it into your hands.
All right, so I'm giving it to you, okay? So, but what does God know?
If you're afraid, go down to the camp with Pura, your servant.
Okay, so what do you think Gideon's going to do? He's going to go down to Pura's servant because he's scared, okay? And you will hear what they say, and afterwards you will be strengthened. So I'm gonna let you go down, and you're going to be able to hear the talk in the camp, okay? And that's going to encourage you. So verse 11, he went down with Pura because he's scared. So he goes down at night, which is Gideon's kind of theme. And this is what he hears in the Midianite camp in verse 12. Read that.
So the people took provisions in their hands and their trumpets, and he sent all the rest of Israel, every man to his tent, but retained the 300 men.
I'm sorry, 12 and 13.
And the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the people of the east lay along the valley like locusts in abundance, and their camels were without number as the sand that is on the seashore's abundance.
So more than 300 people, would you say? A lot more than 300 people, right? So how do you think Gideon reacted to that? Right, he's coming down the hill and he's like, oh, wow, I can't even count them, right? We can get to 300 pretty quick, right? So that's not good. But verse 13.
When Gideon came, behold, a man was telling a dream to his comrade. And he said, behold, I dreamed a dream, and behold, a cake of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian and came to the tent and struck it so that it fell and turned it upside down so that the tent lay flat.
So this guy had a dream, and this is what he says. This little piece of barley bread rolls through our town and destroys everything. And Gideon goes, I'm the barley bread. The band of 300 here. That's the barley bread, okay? So he's scared. God gives him yet another just glimmer of hope. And though these guys far outnumber Gideon and his band, they see a dream from, we presume, from God, okay? And this is the sign that he gave to Gideon again, okay? So he told his friend now tells him in 14, Purah says to Gideon, this is nothing less than the sword of Gideon. You are the barley loaf, right? You are the bread rolling into town. So God has given Midian and all the camp into his hand, okay? So what I like about Gideon is he scared? Yes. Does his fear cripple him? No, right? We've talked about this before, but I think it's just such an important piece to know. Leadership involves fear. Anything stepping out involves fear, okay? The difference between people that do it and don't is not the absence of fear. Gideon is scared, but he moves despite his fear. He's able to overcome his fear, okay? So recognize that as God sends you out in this stuff. You should be scared. If you're not scared at some point in your journey with God, then you are probably not risking enough for him, okay? That doesn't mean every day. That doesn't mean you need to live in fear. But if you're not doing things that are scary in terms of, Lord, this is crazy, right? This is in alignment with what you want me to do, but boy, it is causing my faith meter to panic right now. Then you probably got to reconsider at some point. Like if your journey has been all rose petals and marshmallows, then you know maybe not exactly what God wants for you, or maybe he's calling you for that. Gideon is able to see that, to be fearful, and still go, all right, God, I'm still going to move. Okay, so I appreciate that about him, because more often than not, that is how I feel on the inside. Like, what am I doing, you know, in life? And God, does this make sense? And I'm scared. And, you know, can we pay the mortgage next month? And boy, I got kids and all the stuff that occurs in our head. The reality of life, okay? So Purah, which is nice to have a dude around like this, it says, hey, this is a sign. Let's get after it. So he hears confirmation now from another dude. And he's like, all right, let's do it. 15, watch this guy's change. Okay, now this hasn't happened yet. This is what he foresees. So God's given us this camp, okay? 16.
And he divided the 300 men into three companies.
Ooh, so now we're going to divide them into 100 and 100 and 100. So, I mean, we talk about narrowing down. He had 33,000 people at the beginning. Now he's going to divide these bands further, and he's going to have three different ambushes basically set up, okay? And this is his battle plan. Okay. They're going to take trumpets and empty pitchers and torches. Okay. 17, this is his instruction to them.
And he said to them, look at me and do likewise. When I come to the outskirts of the camp, do as I do. When I blow the trumpet, I and all who are with me then blow the trumpets also on every side of all the camp and shout for the Lord and for Gideon.
All right. So 17, what do you notice about, what does Gideon's leadership look like at this point? Interpret that verse for me. Look at me and do likewise. Do as I do. Yeah, I am scared to death, but I'm going. Do what I do. Watch me. I'm not going to get crippled by fear. I'm going to lead, right? Where does God tell him, take trumpets and pitchers and torches? He doesn't. He figures out a battle plan. He's like, okay, we got 300 people. How are we going to do this? Okay, and Gideon's idea is we need to look like more than 300 people to the Midianites, and that's how they're going to freak out, right? God's already given them into their hand, but does Gideon still have to go fight the battle? Yeah, right? So again, the pattern with God is, look, I'll give them to you, but you got to step out in faith, okay? So, 19, here's how they do it.
So Gideon and 100 men who were with him came to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, when they had just set the watch. And they blew the trumpets and smashed the jars that were in their hands. Then the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the jars. They held in their left hands the torches and in their right hands the trumpets to blow. And they cried out, a sword for the Lord and for Gideon. Every man stood in his place around the camp, and all the army ran. They cried out and fled.
Okay, stop right there. So what did they do? What was this plan? Breaking pitchers and having torches. What is
chaos
and why? What did this sound like to the Midianites? Breaking pitchers, and it sounded like a lot, which means, wow, there must be a ton of people up there. So they're just making a ruckus, right? Smashing pictures, it sounds loud and impressive, so it's dark. They can't see that there's only 300 people coming down the hill, but boy, it sounds like 30,000, which is what they had. But God doesn't want to win with 30,000. He wants to win with 300. So they fake like they're strong when actually they're weak. You know, back in Joshua, God faked like he was weak when he was actually strong. It's like, God, whatever you want to do, okay? We'll win it your way, but this is not my, I don't get to call the shots. God does. So, They are confident, a sword for the Lord, a sword for Gideon, so they scream, they got trumpets. I mean, they're just making a huge ruckus in the middle of the night, right? And these people wake up and freak out. Okay, and 21, each stood in this place around the camp, and the army ran away crying out as they fled, and watch how they defeat this army. 22. So how do they die?
They kill each other.
Because they're like, oh God, it's chaos. You know, I can't see. It's dark. You know, they just start killing each other because they're freaking out. So the same fear that didn't cripple Gideon is the fear that ultimately these guys freak out and kill each other. So it's an interesting, hilarious, brilliant move on God's part. And Gideon gets to be the one that leads these people despite his own fear. So cool picture. Okay. Let's see. End of verse 22. Even throughout the whole army, the army fled as far as Bethshna, toward Zerah, as far as the edge of all these other places. So, yeah, I read that one for you. You're welcome. Yeah, so they're down here. You guys just got it. Yep. Mike cussed again in Hebrew. Yep. So there you go. See, if I got to teach Romans, I wouldn't have to cuss in Hebrew. So they're fleeing now. So the Midianites run. They pursue them. Okay. Now this is crazy. 24. We're about to see some initial seeds of conflict within Israel that are going to blow up underneath. I think it's Jephthah here in a couple of judges. Read 24. All right, so he rallies these dudes from Ephraim, okay? They capture the two leaders, 25 of Midian, Oreb and Zeb, okay? They killed Oreb on the rock of Oreb and Zeb on the winepress of Zeb. So you get killed there, you get it named after you, which is, you know, that's cool. So these two leaders die, okay? While they pursued Midian, and they brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon from across the Jordan, okay? So 8, the guys from Ephraim have an issue. 8:1, read that. Okay, so what is their beef with Gideon, these guys from Ephraim? Why are they mad at Gideon? Huh? They wanted a piece of the action. So they're mad that
They didn't get the email that went out from Gideon saying, hey, we're all going to come fight, and we weren't part of that 32,000 that went out back in chapter 7. Okay, so they get mad. Now, I want you to see how Gideon handles this. This is brilliant. Verse 2. What did he just say to them? You guys are important. Specifically what? What did they do specifically? Yeah, they got the two kings. Like, you're carrying two heads of two kings in your hand. All I did was win this battle. There was no one significant in it. What does he placate to? Yeah, he elevates them, right? Does Gideon need the front page? You guys are a big deal. What am I compared to you? You guys killed the kings. You're bad, right? He just uplifts them. He doesn't fight for them and say, really? Are you whining about the fact that you didn't go to battle and we got the glory? And he's like, I could care, right? So brilliant strategy on his part in that he uplifts these guys in the midst of a tense moment. Verse 1, they contended with him vigorously. They are white hot mad, right? And you're going to see that this is going to blow up later. And Ephraim and Israel are going to go to battle. We're going to have our first civil war within Israel, okay? So these guys are mad. Immediately, Gideon takes all the, he resolves the anger and it's gone, okay? End of verse 3, their anger towards him subsided when he said that. Like, really? Good job. Two verses and immediately he just takes all the frustration out of them because he uplifts them, okay? So you can see that Gideon's got great leadership qualities about him, right? I mean, he's a young, scared guy, but boy, he can rally men. He doesn't need the front page. He gives credit where credit's due. Look, you guys are awesome. Good for you. You took down those guys, right? Oreb and Zeeb, big deal. And they're like, yeah, we did. Thank you, right? Yeah, so he's part of the new generation. Yeah, and at this point, we've been a land for like 300 years, close to it, something like that. So, I mean, we're now multiple generations after, So remember, Ehud reigned for 80 years. I mean, there's a generation right there. We've got a couple other guys that are in there that have also reigned for a while. So we're multiple generations away from the people that originally came to the land. Okay, so yeah, good to remember that. Will be good to note here in a second. We're about to get an Old Testament history from a guy that is dead on. And this has been told now 4 or 5 generations down the line, and he understands exactly what Israel does. So you see that there's still a glimmer of hope. People are obeying the Shema and teaching their kids about what God's done. So we see that in here as well. Okay? So that's the idea. So Gideon's a stud, all right? Verse 4, this was my theme verse going through seminary. Weary yet pursuing. You ever feel that way in life? Like, you are just beat down and tired, but you don't quit. And you know, God, I know that rest is around the corner at some point, but that stupid paper's due, you know, that I got to pull an all-nighter for, or that test, or I'm just worn out from life and stress and people, and I so need a bed or a movie or someone to talk to or some, you know, I just need rest physically, emotionally, spiritually, whatever it is. I need to read and I don't have time. I can't. I'm weary yet pursuing. Okay. So, they are just come off battle. They're tired, but they can't take their foot off the accelerator. They're going to continue to push, even though that's not what they want to do. Weary yet pursuing. Okay. So he says, verse 5, he now comes into this town. Okay. So they've chased these guys all the way down here. Okay. So the battle started up here. Gideon comes all the way down here chasing these chumps. They cross the Jordan River, and now they're in Sukkoth. Okay, we saw that town with Jacob way back in the day. So they've crossed the Jordan, and they're continuing to push these guys out of town. Okay, so he comes in to this town, and that's a pretty long, difficult journey to the leaders. In verse 6, this is what he asks them. I'm sorry, 5. Did we read that yet? 5 first.
So he said to the men of Sukkoth, please give loaves of bread to people who follow me, for they are exhausted.
So what's he ask for? Food for his people, right? Okay, now, this is the other side of the Jordan, okay? There are people in the land from Gad that are should be on his team, right? So these are his people. They're just on the other side of the Jordan. But this is land that Israel has conquered. So he comes to the Gadites, the people specific living in the town of Sukkoth, and says, give me some bread to feed my army. I'm saving Israel right now, right? And this is their response, verse 6. What interpret that? What does that mean?
Are you winning?
Have you already won? Right? So are they going to give him bread? Why? What's their angle? Why don't they want to do that?
Whoever's on their side, who's stronger. We'll give bread to the people that are going to.
We want to be Switzerland. We don't want to choose sides. Okay? Because if we pick you and give you bread and you go to this battle and lose, then what happens? You gave them bread. You're all going to die. Okay? So they lack faith. They don't want any part of that. So they're saying, hey, can you just, we're not against you. We're just not for you, right? So just move on, find another town, okay? Gideon, how do you think he's going to take this? Not so well, right? These are his men. So you see, again, great qualities in him. Feed my men. They're tired. They're weary. He's not asking for too much. Just give us some food, okay? So Gideon says, verse 7, this is harsh. Okay, interpretation is, I'm going to put your hands on the chalkboard and I'm going to spank you with thistles, right? I'm going to beat you senseless until you, like, just bleed, right? That, how dare you not take care of me, okay? So, and I love his confidence, right? So here's a guy that, you know, a chapter ago was scared to death. Now he says, hey, after God delivers these kings into my hand, I'm going to come back and spank all of you for this. How dare you? So You see this, what is inside of Gideon that God saw way back in chapter 6 is finally coming out, right? You've got a confident, not arrogant, but confident leader that says, look, I've seen some signs. God's been faithful before. He'll be faithful again. He wants me to fight. Let's keep going. So obviously not the answer he wanted, but it doesn't stop him. And he says, listen, y'all are going to pay for that. That's dirty. You did me wrong and you're doing my dudes wrong. So we're coming back. Okay. So he rolls out, let's see. He got the same answer in 8. Zeb and Zalmunna, verse 10, and their armies were about 15,000 men who were left in the entire army of the sons of the east. They were fallen 120,000 swordsmen, so they take care of this battle. Gideon keeps going in 11, and then 12, watch what happens here. Okay, so does he win the battle? Absolutely. So he gets exactly what he said. Okay, 14, keep going there.
And he captured a young man of Sukkoth and questioned him, and he wrote down for him the officials and elders of Sukkoth, 77 men. And he came to the men of Sukkoth and said, behold, Zebah and Zalmunna, Malcolm and Utarman, saying, are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna already in your hand, that we should give bread to your men?
Okay, so he comes back, he finds a youth, and he says, who are the leaders? Give me a list of the elders of this city in Sukkoth, okay? And how does he take that? What does he say they did to him? In 15, you taunted me. Like, ooh. Like, you don't want bread? You don't think you can give me that bread because you want to be on my side? That's a taunt. How dare you? He takes it as a challenge, right? That is the, he takes an article from the paper and puts it up in his locker that says, you can't win this battle. And he says, you bet I can. Okay, so he takes that as, take him to task. And hey, you don't think I can win? Yes, I can. So he says, great, here we go. Okay, he took the elders of the city. Verse 16, Evan, keep reading that.
And he took the elders of the city and he took
them
in the wilderness
and briars
and with them taught them in the
Sukkoth. Like, man, he treats them like four-year-olds that got with, you know, their hand caught in the cookie jar. Like, you're getting a spanking now. Like, literally, discipline them is what my version says. So I don't know what that looked like, but I got some pretty funny images in my head. That he just, like, I'm taking you to task, right? And, you know, you're gonna get thorns and thistles on your backside. So take that, okay? So, yeah, he takes them down. Okay, keep going at 18. I'm sorry, 17, and then 18.
He broke down the tower on the hill and killed the men of the city. Then he said to Zibah and Zalmunna, where are the men whom you killed at Tabor? They answered.
So who are these two guys? Where do they go? Zibah and Zalmunna. So he talks to these kings that he's just whooped, okay? And he says, where are the men, my men, that you killed at Tabor? Okay, Tabor is back over in, why is it not on this map? It's in here somewhere. Okay, anyway, so that was part of the battle area. I'm sorry, we're in the wrong area. That's Bitmon. That's why, Mount Tabor. There we go, okay? That's the next king or judge. So the men that you killed at Mount Tabor, okay, where are they? Okay, so his men, he's asking these enemy kings, where are the dudes that you killed, okay? Or, yeah, okay? What were they like? 18, keep going. What is their response? He says, what type of dudes were these guys that you killed at Mount Tabor? And these enemy kings, their answer is, end of verse 18, they were like you, each one resembling the son of a king. What do you call that? Okay. Not just sarcasm. They get a little brown on their nose. Oh, they were awesome, Gideon, just like you, the son of a king, right? So they're placating the Gideon's, hopefully, pride, seeing if, why are they doing that? These are enemy kings that just got captured by Gideon. They're going to die. So I'll kiss your backside hoping that, man, this works out good for me, okay? So
why did he taught the men a lesson from Sukkoth, but the men of Penuel who did the exact same thing die?
I don't know. I think probably the idea is he I don't know if we just don't get the full story in Sukkoth, maybe he killed them as well, but yeah, I don't know. Maybe their crime was worse than 17. Yeah, but no sé, señorita. All right, so keep going in 19. So this is Gideon's answer after they try to kiss his backside. All right, so Gideon says, if you would not kill these guys, I'd let you live. He takes his oldest son and says, go kill him. His oldest son says, man, I'm scared, okay? So like daddy, like son. Zibah and Zalmunna taunt him and say, hey, rise up yourself. Fall on us, for as a man, so is his strength. You're like, really? Are you taunting me to kill you? So Gideon arose and killed Zibah and Zalmunna and took the crescent ornaments which were on their camels' necks, okay? He kills them and takes the spoil of basically their kingly ornaments that would have been impressive on the outside, okay? Now, it's fascinating what happens here. This is a really, like, shifting without a clutch in the chapter. It's like, what just happened, right? So he takes these crescent ornaments, okay? Verse 22, the men of Israel now come to Gideon and say, rule over us, both you and your son and your son's sons, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. What are they asking him to be? A king. And who else? You and your family, okay? So your grandsons will be king. Rule over us. I mean, that's quite the offer, yeah? From a guy that two chapters ago was in a wine press threshing wheat, okay? Now they're saying, you're the guy, you're the king. Let's make you the dynasty, Gideon, okay? And he says to them in verse 23, read that. What, that's a great answer, right? No, I'm not going to be your king, okay? That's not what God desires, okay? You're not going to placate to my pride. I'm not some arrogant, puffed-up guy that's in need of some title or position. That's not what God wants. So he had the sense about him to realize, man, no, we just need to obey God. God's our king, okay? But he does this in verse 24. Read that. Okay, so give me a piece of the spoil that you just took. So give me all your golden earrings. They gave them to him, verse 25. He spread them out on a garment, and they all took their spoil. The weight of all that he took was 1,700 shekels of gold, which is 43 pounds of gold, which is a lot. Okay, and in verse 27, this is what he does with it.
Gideon made an ephod of it and put it in his city in Ophrah.
Okay, so he makes an ephod. What is an ephod? You guys have heard this word before. Chest piece for who? The priest. Okay, that was the garment that they would have worn, the linen ephod. Okay, the whole garment. So he makes a gold dress. Okay, so not sure what the ephod looked like, but the only ephod that we know is the one that the high priest would have worn. So he takes it and he puts it in his city in Orpah. Okay, and this is what Israel does with it. What's that? Read that. Ugh. So he makes this golden ephod, okay? And what is Israel, how do they interpret what he made? What was it? It was an idol. So what do? Worship it. And they treat it as a Baal or Asherah pole, and they have a worship service there and literally hoard after it. You're like, oh, wait a second. Does that sound like what Gideon had intended? Like, I'm not going to be your king. God's your king. Like, this whole thing has been about Gideon's faith, and then all of a sudden, it's like he makes an ephod, and then they all worship Baal and Asherah. He's like, wait a second. My career started because I ripped down those altars. So one of two things is going on. Either Gideon just went nuts, and he now is on team Baal and Asherah again, or he made something, okay? See also the altar that the Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh made when they crossed over the Jordan, and the people went, that's an altar to Baal. And he went, no. It's an altar of remembrance to God. Like, don't freak out. And they went, okay. And Phinehas said, I'm not going to kill all of you today, right? I think that's what he did. He made some type of altar of remembrance to say, this is what God did. The people went, hey, that looks familiar. Let's worship Baal and Asherah there. They all did. And Gideon went, no. That's not what was supposed to happen, okay? So an odd ending to Gideon's life. But I think that Gideon was in... he was just naive to the fact of what the people were going to do with that, because the people were so prone to worship other gods. That's what they did, okay? It became a snare to Gideon and his household. So this thing that was meant for good is not good at all, okay? So notice verse 28, Midian was subdued before the sons of Israel, and they did not lift their heads up anymore, and the land was undisturbed for 40 years in the days of Gideon. So Gideon now rules for 40 years with peace, and then his legacy kind of will continue here in 29 and following. So let's watch how this ends. It's kind of a weird, unfortunate ending.
Rubael, the son of Joash, lived in his own house.
Okay, so that's Gideon. Keep going.
Now Gideon had 70 sons, his own offspring, for he had many wives.
So not what we'd like to read. Okay, so, and he has one specifically from a concubine. Okay. His concubine who was in Shechem bore him a son. His name was Abimelech. Okay, so he's got 70 kids, which is a lot. Like, right, that's a lot. They can make a TV show about that. Oh, wait, I think they did. And Gideon, the son of Joash, died at a ripe old age, so he was buried. So we're assuming that, okay, all ends well with you, Gideon. You were not in the wrong for this, but you kind of screwed up Israel on accident. So whatever. Comes about that when Gideon was dead, that the sons of Israel, surprise, surprise, played the harlot again and made Baal Berith their god. Haven't heard of this one, right? So Baal, we know, means Lord. Berith means covenant. So Lord of the Covenant, which had to be a pretty significant insult to God, who's made a covenant, a Berith, with Israel, and yet now Israel names a false god Lord of the Covenant. So it's like, boy, you guys are jerk faces, right? You just are trying every way possible to make God mad, okay? The sons of Israel did not remember the Lord their God who had delivered them from the hands of their enemies. Verse 34, 35, they did not show kindness to the household of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, in accordance with all the good that he had done. So they forget about Gideon and his works. Okay, but now we've got one of Gideon's kids, verse 9, or chapter 1, verse 9, that's going to rise up. So read that. So Abimelech's kid, or Gideon's kid Abimelech, he goes and makes this, this is a campaign speech. What's he say in verse 2? Pick one. You got 70 kids ruling over you. Is it better to have one or 70? And remember, you and I were family. So they say, you know what? Good point, Abimelech. You're our guy. Okay, so his mother's relatives spoke these words in verse 3. They were inclined to follow Abimelech, and he said,
they said, he is our relative. Okay, so they just picked a new king. Now, what did Gideon not want when he died? He didn't want to be king. He didn't want his family to be king. He said, no, you're not going to serve me. You're going to serve God. Okay, so they gave him, verse 4, this is Abimelech, 70 pieces of silver from the house of Baal-berith, which Abimelech hired, worthless men and reckless fellows, and they followed him. So what do you notice the difference between immediately Gideon and his son right off the bat in terms of people around them? He's a bad dude, and what does he have to do to get people to go with him? Save him, right? Gideon said, hey, come follow me, and people rallied to him. So Abimelech is not a good dude, okay? He's really not a good dude. Read verse 5. Wow. So he takes 70 dudes, his brothers, and kills every one of them. Takes a worthless man and just says, next, dead, next. I mean, that's really, really dirty, okay? So he kills all of his brothers, but the youngest escapes, okay? What is his name? Why did I not mention it there? We'll get it here in a second, okay? So Jotham, there it is, his youngest brother. And this is, so keep going in 6. Let's watch how this unfolds.
And all the leaders of Shechem came together in all Beth-Milo, and they went and made Abimelech king by the oak of the pillar at Shechem.
Okay, so Shechem's going to be his home base. Okay, his youngest brother, Gideon's youngest son, Jotham, is going to he's going to cry out and say, that's dirty, this is wrong. Okay, so he goes into this big dissertation about trees that we won't read, 8 through 14, and he's comparing the leader that they picked in Abimelech to a really strong tree, like, no, you're not that one, no, you're not that one, oh, you're a really weak sissy tree, and that's the one you guys picked to rule over you, okay? So that's where he goes with it, okay? Calls him a bramble tree in verse 15, okay? 16, pick up there, and we'll read Jotham's speech to these people at Shechem who picked the wrong guy as their king. All right, so he basically says, listen, if you honored my father by killing all of his sons and making the worst of the sons king, that's great. Okay, if that's what God wanted, fantastic. However, if you did us all dirty and did my father's reputation dirty, then you're going to pay for this, okay? And this is basically in verse 20, this is the payment. He says, if you're guilty, this is what you're getting. Read that. So let's just set you all on fire and consume all of you if you're wrong. Like, that's quite a statement, okay? After he makes this statement, watch what he does in 21.
And Jonathan ran away and fled and went to Beer.
Yeah, I bet he did. He ran really fast after he just punked a whole town. So, okay, verse 22, Abimelech rules for 3 years in Israel, okay? And then it goes south, all right? God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the men of Shechem. So then now there's some tension between these two. And Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech. So they realize, ooh, this guy isn't all rose petal pass, and he's not all we thought he was. So the men of Shechem are like, maybe we shouldn't have picked him as king. Okay. But what Jotham had predicted is now going to come true. Okay. Keep going, Evan, 24. All right, so they're going to get what's coming to them. Okay, the men of Shechem, verse 25, set an ambush against him on the tops of the mountains. They robbed all who might pass by, okay, along the road, and it was told to Abimelech. So they're trying to get Abimelech impeached, if you will. They want him out of leadership, okay? 28, they roll into the city. Read this. All right, so this guy is the guy that's going to start the coup, okay? Gaal, or whatever his name is, okay? He says, hey, why are we following Abimelech? Why don't y'all follow me, okay? So who's this chump that we should follow him? 29, would therefore that this people be under my authority. So Shechem, you don't want Abimelech to lead anymore? I'll be your guy. Come follow me. And they said, great. Anybody but him, that's fine. Okay? So why don't you come beneath my authority? Verse 30. Sorry, this is like the chapter with a gazillion names. When Zebul, the ruler of the city, heard these words, his anger burned. So this guy is the ruler of Shechem, and he's listening to this. Okay? So Abimelech's king. Who do we follow? And this other city that they're in, he's saying, I don't want to follow him. So he's trying to figure out, is it Gaal that we should follow, or is it Abimelech that we should follow? And he's trying to get his ducks in a row and figure out what to do. Okay? So he sent messengers. Keep going there in 31. Okay, so he tells them, hey, there's about to be a coup against you. Okay, arise by night, you and this people who are with you, and lie in wait in the field. So go ambush these people that are about to come in. Your boy Gaal is going to come spank you if you don't get ready for battle. Okay, let's see. 36, pick up there. Okay, so there are people coming against you. You need to get ready to fight. And then he punks him in verse 38. Listen to this. Like, hey, you just popped off and said, you don't want to follow Abimelech? Follow me? Like, that was all fine and dandy until you got to go fight. So, like, go fight, dude. Quit whining. So Zebul punks Gaal and says, go fight against Abimelech. If you want to be king, what do you think, we're just going to hand this thing to you? Yeah, he's going to fight for it. He wants to be king. So Gaal went out before them in verse 39, the leaders of Shechem, and fought with Abimelech. Abimelech chased him. He fled before him, and many fell wounded up to the entrance of the gate. Then Abimelech remained at Armuth, and Zebul drove out Gaal and his relatives so that they could not remain in Shechem. So Zebul gets what he wants. He gets Gaal out. He gets Abimelech out, and now he's got a city back. And now he's going to let these two guys go fight and figure out how to end this thing, okay? So let's watch this unfold. Let's see. 45, pick up there.
And Abimelech fought against the city all that day. He captured the city and killed all the people who were in it. And he raised the city and sowed it.
That's not good. Okay, so they just set the city on fire, okay? Let's see. Let's continue the battle. Verse 48. Okay, so he's going to get this big branch. He's going to tell his leaders that are with him to do the same. They're going to set these things on fire, and this is what they're going to do with them in verse 51. Keep going.
But there was a strong tower within the city, and all the men and women and all the leaders of the city fled to it and shut themselves in.
All right, so they go climb in this tower. Abimelech's got a branch, and with all his men have branches, okay? So they are shut up in this tower, and this is 52, rather, what they do. All right, so he's going
to
go set this on fire. That's what his plan is. But 53, this is funny.
And a certain woman threw an upper millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull.
Just like that, right? He's been in all these battles, and some woman goes, whoop, done, right? So she drops this millstone, which is like just a big, heavy rock, from this tower and kills him instantly, okay? So funny, that's how this guy goes down. And he's got so much pride that this is what he asks now. 54, read that. I can't die. When everyone said, oh, you got killed by a woman in battle. Like, you went through all these battles with dudes, and then some woman kills you at the end of it all. Okay? Keep going.
And when the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, everyone departed to his home.
All right. So God now, verse 56, repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done for killing his 70 brothers. And also, verse 57, read that. Yours says Jonathan. Is that your translation? No, that's okay. I said no if his name was both. Sometimes it's that way in certain texts, okay? So remember Gideon's youngest son that says, hey, if you guys were
if you did my father wrong and did me dirty, your city's going to get cursed. And sure enough, at the end of this battle, their city gets cursed because they were dirty. All right? So that's the idea. All right? Make a sense? Sorry, lots of kings, lots of names, lots of crazy confusion. But at the end of the day, God gets vengeance upon the city of Shechem, and Abimelech, this dirty, filthy, McNasty son of Gideon, dies at the hands of a woman. So take that, all right? 10, 1 and 2, we get two verses on Tola. Okay, he is the next judge. He reigns for 23 years in Israel. He arose to save Israel, so we get two verses on him. Good dude. And then Jair is 3 through 5. And then we're going to get a description of, in 6 and following, I just want you to read 10, verse 6, the number of gods that are mentioned in verse 6. Read that. So as you just look through there, those are 7 different false gods that are mentioned in a verse. So Israel's like, bring anybody and everybody that we can serve, and we want to serve them. We want to bow down to Moab's gods, Sidon's gods, Aram's gods, the Philistines' gods, Amnon's gods, any and all of them, bring them. So obviously God's not happy about this, okay? And you're going to see something out of God's mouth that we have not seen before. His anger is going to burn in a way that is new, okay? Verse 7, the anger of the Lord burned against Israel. He sold them to the hands of the Philistines. We've seen this before. They afflicted and crushed the sons of Israel for 18 years as they worshiped all these false gods. God says, great, hands off the steering wheel. If that's what you want, you can have it, okay? The sons of Israel who are beyond the Jordan and Gilead and the land of the Amorites, okay? Verse 10, Israel finally comes to her senses. Read that.
The people of Israel cry out to the Lord, saying, we have sinned against you because we have forsaken our God and have served the Baal.
All right, so good. All right, you realize that you've been getting spanked for 18 years because you've been serving the wrong gods again, okay? God's answer, verse 11 and 12 and 13. Now, compare 11 and 12 to what we saw in verse 6. What is God saying? Who are all these gods that you're worshiping?
The ones I've already beaten.
But you're worshiping them anyway. So have I not already defeated all of these gods who, by the way, you spent the last 18 years worshiping instead of me? God's saying, I've already proven that I am, you know better, right? This is not a you didn't know this or whatever. God has proven that he's a bigger deal than all of these gods, okay? Verse 13, yet you have forsaken me and have served other gods. So verse 13, what does God say?
Go and cry out to you.
End of verse 13.
You have forsaken me and served other gods. Therefore, I will save you no more.
I will deliver you no mas. I am done delivering you. In fact, you like your other gods so much, verse 14. That's what you want to worship? Get after it. Cry out to your G.I. Joe gods and see if they will rescue you, right? What a, just a backhanded slap, right? If that's what you want, fantastic. You've served them. You got what you want from them. Now see if they'll deliver you because I am done, okay? So does God's patience finally come to an end where he says, no mas? Scary, right? So he says, great, okay? Now, I want you to notice, something's going to occur here. What does Israel at least appear to do in these sentences? What have we seen? What does it seem like they've done at least vocally? Repent, right? It sounds like they've repented. However, what have they failed to do? They failed, it looks like, to take any action with it. So God says, no, I'm done. So verse 15, the sons of Israel said to the Lord, we have sinned. Do to us whatever seems good to you, only please deliver us this day. Verse 16, what do they do?
They put away the foreign gods from among them, and serve the Lord.
So what had they failed to do to this point? Okay, so they had lip service to God, but did they have any external change? No. What is repentance? The word repentance literally has in its meaning, it's like a U-turn on a highway. You don't just change your mind, you change your direction. You do a 180 and say, I am going the other way, okay? They said, God, we repent, but I still like my G.I. Joe gods, so I'm not going to give these up, but I feel really bad. So the idea is, no, you don't feel bad. You feel bad about your circumstances and that now it's what was awesome in your worship is now going bad and you're being oppressed and you've basically gotten caught. So you're repenting because you got caught. But you don't want to give up anything. You don't really want to change. So God calls him to the carpet. You don't want to change. You don't want to worship me because you don't want to give up any of the stuff that I'm asking you to give up, okay? But they finally give up their foreign gods and watch what God does. This is a great just picture into the mind and heart of God. Read 16 again for me, Evan, the whole thing. Mine says he could bear the misery of Israel no longer. Isn't that great? Like God is, how is God during this time? He is torn up and grieving like a parent whose son or daughter has gone wayward. And they love them, they care for them, but they are willing to allow them to experience the consequences of their actions because they know if I come in and rescue them, they're not going to learn anything. So they're going to have to experience some pain, and I will be here when it's all over to love them and care for them. Okay, so beautiful picture of God's heart in the midst of that. Okay, let's finish out the chapter. Read 17 and 18.
Then the Ammonites were called up out of the camp of Gilead, and the people of Israel came together and they became an oppression. And the people, the leaders of Gilead said one to another, who is the man who will begin to fight against the Ammonites? He shall bear head over all the inhabitants of Gilead.
All right, on Thursday, next Thursday, we will find out the man that's going to step up. His name is Jephthah, and he is the next judge who's now going to deliver Israel now that they have repented, put away their foreign gods for a season, as is the case with them. And this guy named Jephthah is going to raise up and deliver them. Jephthah's a good dude, okay? He is an underdog, a lot like Gideon. He's the least and the last and a nobody, and yet God's going to use him in pretty significant ways, all right? So there you go. We've looked at a number of judges. We got a few left. And obviously, as we've seen, it's going to get darker before it gets better. All right? So there you go. We'll pick up chapter 11 next week.